ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam. What's the verse today? Is it chapter 7? 17. Well, I prepared for chapter 7. chapter 17. Okay, let's take a quick look at this. Okay, well, let's see. It might work anyway. Yeah, let's stay on chapter 17. Because I see a verse here that fits with what I was going to talk about. So let's turn to text number 37 of chapter 17. So I'll read the word-for-word meanings, and then we can chant together. Tat therefore me, dharma britam, of all protectors of religion, shreshta, O chief, sthanam, place, nirdeshtam, fix, arhasi, may you do so, yatra, where, eva, certainly, nityata, always, vatsye, can reside, atistan, permanently situated, te, your, anusashanam, under your rule. Tanme dharma britam shreshta, sthanam nirdeshtum arhasi, yatraiva nityato pachya, atistam te nudasasasasanam. Tanme dharma britam shreshta, sthanam nirdeshtum arhasi, yatraiva niyato vachya, atistam te nushasanam. Tanme dharma britam shreshta, sthanam nirdeshtum arhasi, yatraiva niyato vachya, atistam te nushasanam. Okay. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Therefore, O Chief among the protectors of religion, please fix some place for me where I can live permanently under the protection of your government. So this is a section where Kali, the personality Kali, personality of this age that we live in, Kali Yuga, which is an age called the age of hypocrisy, where people are always lazy, misguided, and unfortunate. And those terms are meant in relation to one's spiritual interest and capabilities for making spiritual advancement. Kali Yuga is not very favorable. So in this section of the Bhagavatam, he's making his appearance and being accosted by Maharaj Parikshit, who is a king, Dharmaraj, a king, a religious king. So I'll read the verses up to this because we're supposed to cover 33 through 38. I'll read the translations to those verses and the purport to this text we just read. Therefore, O friend of irreligion, this is Parikshit addressing Kali. Therefore, O friend of irreligion, you do not deserve to remain in a place where experts perform sacrifices according to truth and religious principles for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In all sacrificial ceremonies, although sometimes a demigod is worshipped, the Supreme Lord Personality of Godhead is worshipped because He is the Supersoul of everyone and exists both inside and outside like the air. Thus, it is He only who awards all welfare to the worshipper. Suta Goswami said, the personality of Kali, thus being ordered by Maharaj Parikshit, began to tremble in fear. Seeing the king before him like Yamaraj, ready to kill him, Kali spoke to the king as follows. O your majesty, though I may live anywhere and everywhere under your order, I shall but see you with bow and arrows wherever I look. Therefore, O chief amongst the protectors of religion, please fix some place for me where I can live permanently under the protection of your government. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The personality of Kali addressed Maharaj Parikshit as a chief amongst the protectors of religiosity because the king refrained from killing a person who surrendered unto him. A surrendered soul should be given all protection, even though he may be an enemy. That is the principle of religion. And we can just imagine what sort of protection is given by the personality of Godhead to the person who surrenders unto him, not as an enemy, but as a devoted servitor. The Lord protects surrendered souls from all sins and all resultant reactions of sinful acts. Bhagavad Gita 18:66. Suta Goswami said, Maharaj Parikshit, thus being petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. Om Gyanatimarananta Shaganamjana Shalakaya Chakshunamaditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Actually, it's very interesting because the subject matter that I wanted to speak on today was how do we deal with subordinates, especially those who are at our mercy. And so this is exactly the subject matter of the verse here today. The verses that I had read in preparation for talking on this subject dealt with when Arjuna had captured Ashwatthama. You know, at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, which is the battle which is described in Bhagavad Gita, at the end of that battle, there were a few soldiers remaining. Among them were the five sons of the Pandava brothers, the side of righteousness. They had five sons. And those five sons were killed when they were sleeping by Ashwatthama. And So when this was discovered, Arjuna went out and he captured Ashwatthama and he had him as a prisoner of war. And so there's discussion there about what should be done with him between Arjuna and Krishna. They were discussing what should be done with Ashwatthama, who has done this heinous act of killing warriors when they were sleeping. So he was a prisoner of war, or someone completely at the mercy of his captor. So the subject matter there was, how do we deal with subordinates or those at our mercy? And similarly, the subject matter here is the same thing. How does King Parikshit, who is described in these verses we just read as being a very powerful king, Dharmaraj, king of religion, how does he deal with someone who he has subdued and who is at his mercy? That's the subject matter. And it's kind of an appropriate subject matter because who knows what tomorrow is? Saturday. Okay. Who said that? Well, tomorrow is Ram Navami, the appearance day of Lord Ramachandra. And Lord Ramachandra, as you all know, is the Lord's incarnation as a human being. Maryada Purushottam. He appeared in this world as the best of all human beings. And therefore, his activities are particularly relevant for human beings to study and understand. He was a king, his example is very, very important for us as human beings, because he acted as the perfect role model for how we should act, Lord Ramachandra. And during his activities, during his lifetime, his pastimes, there are several themes which are very important in regard to this idea about protecting subordinates. And dealing with people who have done something wrong, particularly done something wrong to you personally. As you know, in Lord Ramachandra's pastimes, what's the main wrong that was done to Lord Ramachandra? Can anybody say? His wife was stolen. Yes. So I guess, wait a minute, I guess there are a lot of wrongs in his life. That's not the one I was thinking about. So his wife was stolen. That was certainly a wrong done to him. What other wrongs? He was exiled. He was supposed to be the king the next day he was supposed to be the king, but there was some intrigue in the palace and he was kicked out. So, anything else that happened to him that anybody can recall? Anyway, those are two major things that happened to him. And so he was wronged in his life. And so how did he react to that? How did he react to that? I think how he reacted to that situation, those situations, is particularly important for us to understand and study, because, as I said, he appeared as an ideal human being, and the Lord's purpose whenever he comes in this world is to teach by his example how we should deal with this material nature that we find ourselves in. Now, of course, he didn't appear during Kali Yuga. He appeared during the Treta Yuga, which was an age where there was more religiosity. And so, if some of his actions seem extraordinary to us in Kali Yuga, and I think they will seem extraordinary to us in Kali Yuga, it's because of the differences in the age. He appeared in an age, obviously, where there was more of a religious sort of undertone to everything that took place in society, which is not necessarily the case in Kali Yuga. So how did he react to these things, to his wife being stolen and to being denied the kingdom unfairly? Can anyone say how he reacted? Vaishnav, Mike's here.
For when he was exiled, he accepted it wholeheartedly because it was his father's order in a way.
Mm.
But when his wife was abdicated, he was pretty angry and he said he's going to annihilate the whole universe. then Lakshman stopped him.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, good. Good. So let's take the first one, that when he was, even though there was some palace intrigue, we won't describe that here, but there was some palace intrigue where he was unfairly exiled to the forest on the order of his father. He didn't become angry and try to overcome those obstacles. He accepted the order of his father and left the kingdom in a very peaceful way. Instructive that when reverses happen to us in life, we shouldn't look and start blaming others. You're at fault for this. And I think we talked about this just last week or the week before. Blaming and the real fault in doing that, blaming others for our own circumstances. But no, he accepted it and performed the duties of exile that were given to him by his fathers, by his father. As far as when Sita was taken from him, he became angry, and as a result of that, there was a whole war between Lord Ramachandra and Ravana. And here's where the verses that we're studying today and the verses in that I prepared for in the seventh chapter differ. Those verses there in the seventh chapter, again, relate to Arjuna capturing Ashwatthama, and he was talking with Krishna about what he should do. And there's a very interesting description found there. It says that Arjuna's eyes were red like burning copper. The verse describes there, his eyes are red, burning like copper. And Krishna's eyes were described as lotus, like a lotus petal. Both are described as being angry, but Arjuna's eyes are red like copper, and Krishna's eyes are like a lotus petal. And Srila Prabhupada, in his purport, makes a very relevant distinction between the type of anger that was being displayed by the two of them. Arjuna's anger, he explained, was, and again, this is for teaching for our benefit, was coming more from the idea of a material kind of point of view, that this person had done something wrong. He had killed his own son, you know, when his son was sleeping, which was against the rules of warfare. And he had broken the heart of Draupadi, the mother of these five children. And Arjuna was angry in a material sense. Whereas Krishna, his eyes were described as like a lotus petals, indicating that his vision was transcendental. That although he was angry, he didn't have the bad qualities, the passionate and ignorance qualities of anger that were being displayed by Arjuna. And so when Ramachandra was angry, which do you think he reflected in his eyes? We have no description before us, but which feeling was in his eyes, do you think, Lord Ramachandra, when Sita was stolen? Okay, transcendental, yeah. I mean, he's a personality of Godhead, so obviously he's transcendental. Yes, and what is a different characteristic of anger under the modes of nature, as exemplified by Arjuna, and the transcendental anger represented by Krishna? That's the subject matter that we'll discuss today. You have some? Compassion on the side of Krishna. Anger, compassion, yeah? Okay, to benefit the other person. Doesn't just take advantage of your position of superiority over them. Okay. Good. Anyone else have anything? Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay, when we're attached to something material, transcendental anger arises. That's described in Bhagavad Gita. Attached to Krishna, something different. Yes?
Our anger is more out of fear. Krishna's anger, or Ram's anger, is more out of maybe he's fighting. He's fighting potential. He's a little excited. He gets the fight.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the Lord's enjoyment of the fighting rasa is not motivated by the same kind of fear that motivates material. Yes. All right. Okay. So there's a difference between a loving-based anger that might be justified or for your benefit as compared to someone as just a disturbance. So very good. Very good. Yes.
The anger of Krishna, Rama or his pure devotee, is as described in chapter 34 of Nectar of Devotion, called a Vyabhichari Bhava, which is a type of transcendental emotion enacted by Yoga Maya, the internal potency of the Lord to fulfill the desire of the Lord, either for separation or for fighting or whatever it might be. Whereas our anger is enacted by Mahamaya under the influence of ignorance.
Right. So in the spiritual world, as Damodar is explaining, there are different types of emotions as well. Not that it's impersonal there. There are people there, the Lord is there, and there's exchanges of love. And this anger he's describing as a Vyabhachari Bhav is something that is an expression of the loving exchange between the Lord and his devotees. These are all very good because they do point to the basic difference. And I want to illustrate for you some of that difference by taking a look at this idea of what we do with someone who's at our mercy in the material world and what we do when someone is at our mercy in the spiritual world. And I think this is relevant for all of us because at some point or another in our lives, all of us are going to be in a situation where we have some subordinates who are basically at our mercy, whether they're our dependents or whether they're our co-workers and we're a boss on a job or we're the head of the temple and we have devotees in the temple serving underneath us. At some point or another, we're going to have people that are basically at our mercy as dependents, and I think it's important to take lessons from the Shastra and how we should deal with that situation. And that's because of a famous experiment that was done at Stanford University on guards, prison guards. Is anybody familiar with this? You familiar with that? I have just some statistics on that experiment just to give you some idea. And this illustrates what happens in the material world when people at our mercy. The Stanford prison guard experiment was a controversial study of the psychological effect of becoming a prisoner or a prison guard. The experiment was conducted at Stanford University from August 14th to August 20th, 1971, by a team of researchers led by a psychology professor, Zimbardo. 24 male students out of 75 were selected to take on randomly assigned roles as prisoners and guards in a mock prison situated in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Building. Now, these were college students, ordinary people, just selected at random. No one that necessarily had a bad, psychological background or criminal background, just randomly selected students. Huh? Volunteers. Okay. These participants adapted to their roles well beyond Zimbardo's expectation as guards enforced authoritarian measures and ultimately subjected some of the prisoners to psychological torture. Many of the prisoners passively accepted psychological abuse and at the request of the guards readily harassed other prisoners who attempted to prevent it. The experiment even affected Zimbardo himself, who in his role as a superintendent permitted abuse to continue. Two of the prisoners quit their experiment early, and the entire experiment was abruptly stopped after only, how long do you think it went for? More than one day. Yeah, it went 6 days. It went 6 days. In 6 days, these type of psychological adjustments were made in a mock prison. It wasn't a real prison. It was just in the basement of the psychology building. I mean, and they weren't criminals. I mean, these were just, it was just a play. It was just playing, going, role playing going on here. But it says the guards and the prisoners adapted to the roles that were more than they were expected, stepping beyond the boundaries of what had been predicted, leading to dangerous and psychologically damaging situations. One-third of the guards were judged to have exhibited genuine sadistic tendencies. While many prisoners were emotionally traumatized, and two of them had to be removed from the experiment early. So the whole point of this experiment, or at least the unexpected results of this experiment, were that frightening implications about the dangers which lurk in the dark side of human nature were revealed. And so when we're in this material world, even an ordinary person put in a situation can, out of him can be evoked very dark behavior. Because that behavior is coming from the conditioning and material nature which allows even an ordinary person in the wrong situation to act in very horrible ways in relation with his fellow human beings. What to speak of if anger is actually provoked, how difficult it can be. And actually we see that that anger being evoked in situations where people are prisoners of war. Someone's completely at your mercy as a prisoner of war, and how would you deal with them? There are some really dark human nature stories about prisoners of war. People are completely at your mercy. I have some of them here, and I'll share a little bit of that with you, just to give you some idea about material nature. That's the point. Material nature is not a very rosy kind of picture. At the beginning, or at least when there were rumblings of war in this country during the Civil War, one Union general, his name was William Sherman, he was speaking to the people, and he said to the people of the South that you kind of have this romantic view of what war is about, but actually war is hell, and we shouldn't resort to war to resolve our differences, although we see that in the modern world people do that all the time. But the reason, one of the reasons why he called war as hell, is because of this human nature that comes out, the dark side of human nature. And that was particularly shown in some of the prison camps that they had there. Do you want to hear just a little bit about some of those prison camps? We are going to get to a brighter subject here. But just to complete this picture of the dark side of human nature, conditioned by the modes of nature, particularly in Kali Yuga, there was one camp in the South, maintained by the Confederate Army at Andersonville in South Carolina. Is it in Georgia? Andersonville is in Georgia? Okay. The Confederates lacked necessary tools for adequate housing. Some of the early prisoners were able to construct a few rude huts of scrap wood. Many sought shelter in dilapidated tents. Others dug holes in the ground for protection, but hundreds had no shelter of any kind against the pouring rain, southern heat, and winter cold. No clothing was provided, and many prisoners were transferred to Andersonville from other camps, were dressed only in rags. Even decent clothing deteriorated quickly, and some prisoners had virtually nothing to wear. A stream flowed through the treeless stockade, dividing it roughly in half. It quickly became polluted with waste, creating a horrible stench over the whole camp. The poorly equipped and staffed camped hospital was woefully inadequate to deal with the wretched conditions. Confederate surgeon Joseph Jones called Andersonville, quote, a giant mass of human misery. Now, this was a situation where up to 46,000 soldiers were at the mercy of prisoners, were at the mercy of their captors. And this is the kind of conditions they let them live in. 28% of those persons died in the camp. Now, in the north, just to be fair here, there was a camp in Elmira, New York. And there, two watchtowers, two observation towers were erected right outside the prison walls. And for 15 cents, spectators could watch the wretched prisoners within the compound. When winter struck Elmira in late 1864, prisoners lacking blankets and clad in rags collapsed in droves from exposure. By early December, half-naked men stood in ankle-deep in snow to answer morning roll call. New York, we're talking about New York State here. This winter's not like here. And they were half naked in ankle deep snow. What kind of a human being could go and pay 15 cents and stand in that tower and look at these people suffering? The guards in the Stanford experiment. I don't know. Well, at least there was some proper retribution for that. In terms of the Stanford experiment, an attempt to explain it away. But even if they were enacting rules they saw in society, what does that say about society? I mean, yeah, there were some other ones. Right. There were some other experiments related to this that also revealed this kind of behavior. Daniel, you had something you wanted to say? Okay, that's a good comment, and I think it leads us to a brighter subject matter here. Yeah, Daniel questions the humanity of persons that are living entities that engage in these type of actions, and I think that's a good observation, because the fact is that our humanness becomes degraded by the age of Kali. That's the whole point of the onslaught of the age of Kali, that one's real human qualities become degraded and begin to disappear. And therefore we find it replaced by the type of behavior here, like that. Now, what can actually stop that decline in human behavior in Kali Yuga? Yes, Daniel? Right, okay. Right, the four principles of religion can stop these things. And say them again. What are they? Four principles of religion? Cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, and austerity. Yes, these are four principles of religion, and when things are done on the basis of those four principles of religion, they may be the same thing happening. Just like Krishna was angry, Ramachandra was angry, but the manifestation of the anger did not deviate from the practice of religious principles or being based in religious principles. And to prove that, I have some information for you about war in ancient India, which was Dharma Yuddha, religiously based war, and how they dealt with prisoners of war. So let me just read some of the things from this book about how prisoners of war were treated in terms of a Dharma Yuddha, or a warfare based on religious principles. One should fight only one enemy and cease fighting when the opponent becomes disabled. Poisoned or barbed arrows should not be used. What happened during World War I? Poison warfare. A weak or wounded man should not be killed, nor one who has no son. A king should fight only with a king and not with warrior of inferior status. If a Brahmin enters the field to bring about peace between the contesting parties, both should stop fighting and no injury should be inflicted on such a Brahmana. The panic-stricken or scattered foe should not be pursued hotly. Aged men, women, children, the retreating, or one who holds a straw in his lips as a sign of unconditional surrender should not be killed. No one should kill the sleepy or the thirsty or the fatigued, or one whose armor has slipped, a peaceful citizen walking along the road, one engaged in eating or drinking, the mad, the insane, one who went out of the camp to buy provisions, a camp follower, menials, and the guards at the gates. It is further prohibited to fight with those who do not offer to fight, who hide themselves in fear, or who go to the field as spectators. The great war at Kurukshetra affords ample proof that spectators were admitted into the battlefield during the scenes of action, and they were not injured or otherwise harmed. Prisoners of war were generally to be accorded generous treatment. In the epic of the Brahmana, the fretted prisoners were sent out of the kingdoms and were permitted to remain on the outskirts. Sometimes a captive agreed to become a slave of the captor for a period of 1 year, after which he became a free man. If maidens were among the prisoners of war, they were courteously treated and were induced to marry persons of the conqueror's choice. If they declined the offer, they were sent back to their homes under proper escort. Hospitality, the sacredness of the refugee, the law, not to forget a kindness or a hurt, and not to refuse to fight when challenged are some of the features of fair fighting according to the epic code. Usually the defeated king was reinstated on the throne, but if the enemy king had met his death in the battle, his son or nearest relative was installed on the throne on terms of subordinate alliances. So, I mean, you get a different picture here. Now, I don't want to be naive and say that in Vedic warfare, which is Dharma Yuddha, there weren't violations, because we know in the Mahabharata war, there were. And one famous one is when Karna's chariot got stuck in the mud. And he got down off his chariot to unstuck his chariot. And what happened at that point? What did Krishna tell Arjuna? He said, Krishna, you kill him. You kill him now. And so why did Krishna himself, the personality of God, and Supreme Person, why did he break the codes of Dharma Yuddha, or religiously based warfare? What was his response when Karna said, "Well, wait a minute, you know, I'm out on my chariot. This is against the rules of war." What did he say? Karna had broken some rule previously. Just some rule? What did he do? What did Krishna say to him? Yeah, he had been there, and when they insulted Draupadi, trying to strip her naked in the assembly of kings. And so Krishna reminded him, where was your dharma at that stage? Where was your dharma then? So, and they also killed Abhimanyu unfairly in the fight. So many things took place, and so war is hell, whether it's Dharma Yuga or Kali Yuga. But the point is that at least if there's dharma or religiosity involved, it can keep us, as Daniel says, on the human platform. It keeps us on the human, and we don't descend to subhuman behavior where we treat each other with such inhumanity that it's appalling. Whether it be prisoners of war or anyone that's subject to our authority. And Lord Ramachandra exhibited this during his pastimes as well. There were two particular instances in Lord Ramachandra's pastimes where he showed that even though he was angry that his wife had been captured and stolen away unfairly by Ravana, and that he acted on that anger was still controlled by the reins of dharmic or religious behavior. The first example in her mind is when Ram sent Hanuman to find Sita. And throughout many trials and tribulations, Hanuman finally found Sita in Lanka, and then he was captured by Ravana and brought before Ravana. And Ravana, what was his immediate response? Yes, he said, "Kill him! Kill him!" But then what happened? Who spoke up and what did they say? Bibhishan spoke, and what did he say? Yes, he brought in a principle of Dharma Yuddha. He said, "Wait a minute, according to the rules, the religious rules of wars of religious warfare, you cannot kill a messenger, an envoy. That's sinful. And if you do," and I don't have the exact quote pulled out, but in this book it describes what kind of hell you go to if you kill an envoy. And so Ravana listened to him. He said, "Okay, well, we won't kill him." Even Ravana was to that stage where he didn't completely reject this. He said, "We'll set his tail on fire." So Dharma, that was one example in their mind, how this of the religious warfare. The other one, again, relates to the theme of today of prisoners of war, and that is when Vibhishan, Ravana's brother, who had brought up this point to Ram about not killing an envoy, when he got fed up with Ravana and decided to leave him, he left and went to surrender to Lord Ramachandra. And when he was coming with a couple of his associates to Lord Ramachandra, the other monkey soldiers in Ram's army said what? Yeah, kill them. Here's the enemy, you know. Here's our chance. They're not defending themselves. Let's kill them. But what was Ram's response? And this response is quoted by our acharyas as not just to applying to Dharma Yuddha, but to apply to our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead in all circumstances. What was Lord Ramachandra's reply? Go ahead. Yes. He said that if one once surrenders to me, I promise that I'll give him eternal shelter and protection. And so this is a principle of Dharma Yuddha. If someone comes and surrenders, they should not be killed. That surrender should be accepted, and they should be given shelter. But the Lord is so kind, and his anger and his execution of Dharma Yuddha is so transcendental that this instruction applies to all people at all places and all time. That if we once surrender to Lord Ramachandra, he offers us protection eternally. And so that is something that we should take advantage of, each and every one of us. We may not find ourselves in a situation where we're in warfare, but we'll always find ourselves in a situation where we need to surrender to the protection of the Supreme Lord. And he's ready. He's ready for us, as exemplified with this pastime from the Ramayana. So, in conclusion, we should always try to take these principles in our life when we deal with subordinates, to try to deal with compassion, mercy, with the four things, with cleanliness, austerity, truthfulness, and mercy. Those four things should be elements of our interaction with subordinates, with equals, with superiors that we meet in life, and then we'll be happy and satisfied. We won't have those copper red eyes like Arjuna had. So are there any questions or comments about these subject matters? Anyone has? Yes?
I'm sure they didn't think that.
That's fine.
I'm sure they didn't think that they had this dark side to them in there, and they acted in that way. And so I was hearing this, and I was thinking, wow, you know, these dark sides might be within us that we may not think that that's there. And it's kind of scary to hear that. Young students, innocent, and yet they were able to display such dark side.
Yeah, well, there's a lot written on this, and our friend probably knows, you know, quite more than I do on it. But there's a lot written on this, and as I read in the beginning, it was controversial. Controversial to start with, and probably still controversial to this day, that such a thing was actually undertaken, because there were some psychologically damaging effects that developed. It only lasted 6 days. And in that period, there's some psychologically damaging elements that emerged. So that is a problem that we have that's within us, yes. And we should be aware of it. That's why I wanted to bring it up today. Yes, Joe.
And you're like, but I don't want to put down my weapons. our weapons aren't, you know, rifles and grenades or anything like that. Our weapons are our desire to control and exploit, and our different propensities that we have like that. So it's like we're saying we're surrendering, but then we walk into someone's house and we eat right off their plate, take it from them, we don't even ask. We go in, we use this, we don't even ask. We're doing like this. So when our actions and activities are contradicting our... I surrender. Yes, I surrender. You know, I was just noticing how much that stands out in my own spiritual life, where my actions aren't so much with what it is that I'm wanting to do, and getting that opportunity to see it and actually put down my weapons. You know, It's a really tough thing to do. I don't want to put it down.
Yeah, surrender is a matter of the heart. It's not necessarily an external manifestation. It's a matter of the heart. We have to be willing in our heart to really take shelter of Krishna, take shelter of his devotees, and leave aside our guards, you know, and our security of in those rifles and weapons and things like that. Yeah. Good, thank you. Yes?
Association, and like you're saying, that the leaders of these situations have to have have to be following these principles of religion. Like, it's my grandfather was actually a prisoner of war at Stalag Luft 3, which is a famous prison camp that the Great Escape happened from. He was there for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And he always said, it was shocking to me, but he always said the Germans were such fair. How do you say people in charge of captors? They were very fair. He said he got backhanded one time, but other than that, they had like theater. They were allowed to do so many things that he actually said he had a good time. Being a prisoner of war for 2.5 years. Yeah, he was, but.
Okay.